This morning, I was giving you some general impressions of the present situation of Zen in Japan, and showing how it's really fallen on evil days. It has a very little interest to the younger generation, and insofar as there is an awakening, it is to a considerable extent due to the increase of Western interest, which has aroused the Zen people and put them on their mettle. And now I want to discuss a problem that was raised by both R.H. Blythe and D.T. Suzuki as to whether Zen, as one finds it in Japan today, is rather much behind the times, ill-suited to Western assimilation, and even for purposes of the Japanese, needs in some way to be reformed, and if so, in what directions. Now, frankly, I must be very, very clear with you as to what are and are not my qualifications to discuss this. I have not studied Zen in the regular way. I have not spent any time practicing Zen in a monastery, and I have never acquired a formal Zen teacher, because my method in approaching situations is invariably through the back door. This shows me the construction underneath the front stairs. I'm a bit sneaky. But I find this, although sometimes it takes longer to get in by the back door than by the front door, nevertheless it has certain advantages. Ramakrishna said there are many entrances to a house. One entrance is the way the garbage goes in and out. Another entrance is where the honored guests go in and out. And in discussing various forms of Hinduism, which go under the name of the left-hand path, he said they do get into the house, but they go by the garbage entrance. Well, I suppose I go in like a burglar through the window. Or something like that. But the reason, I have a reason for this. There is method in my madness. And it's this. I don't care what you join, be it a Buddhist group, a yoga group, a Christian group, a psychoanalytic group, whether you are an advocate for spiritual methods of anything, psychedelic drugs or dervish dancing, or Gurdjieff exercises, or whatever, you tend to become, by virtue of this, a member of an in-group. And you start playing the game of in-group versus out-group. And it never fails, so far as I can see. Now, it's absurd to try and constitute an in-group of one. I would think myself very funny if I tried to do that. So at least I can avoid that. But then, everybody's out of step except me, sort of thing. That just doesn't strike my sense of humor very well, for me. But everywhere there is this tendency. And I feel, too, that people are always in danger of playing games indefinitely along this, saying, well, we're more inclusive than you are. I'm more tolerant than you are. There are fascinating games along these lines. I'm more aware of my shortcomings than you are. I know more consciously than you do that I play games. It is perfectly endless. But I think that our friend Krishnamurti has always had a very powerful critique in this problem, in saying that religions are divisive. Even if they, let's take the Baha'i thing. Now here was an attempt to form a universal religion composed of 9 major religions in the world. And all it succeeded in doing was creating another divisive sect, claiming to be a certain in-group. And so I feel rather strongly in this day and age that joining religions is intellectually not so very respectable. That it is a thing of the past. Now, the people object to that and say, well, all you become in, if you do that, is an eclectic. Or they'll say, this is syncretism, which is a dirty word in some circles. That, in other words, you become superficial. You are like you treat the whole religious history of mankind as smorgasbord. And you go round to all the dishes and pick what catches your fancy and leave the rest. Well, people do that anyhow. If they take one tradition, I know all kinds of Catholics who say we are devout Catholics, but of course we don't go along with this, that, and the other, and all the silly nonsense about birth control and so on. They just take as much Catholicism as they feel they can take and leave the rest. Any discriminating eater does that. If you don't, you don't know the difference between chalk and cheese. So I find nothing, if somebody wants to call me a syncretist, a dilettante, or whatever you like, the shoe doesn't fit, so I don't wear it. So this is my attitude and the way I look at it, and you must make up your own mind whether you think this qualifies me to say anything valid at all or not. But I watch many things. I watch the claims people make and whether they manifest those claims in the way they live. And if they say, well, you know, this way of life that we follow is going to improve us and make us better human beings from a moral point of view, all right, that's what they said it did. So I watched to see if they are in any way distinguished. And it's very rarely true that they are. To a large extent, people's religious beliefs are a rationalization of some kind. And so, it's better, I think, not to make claims. Not to try, because you see, this is always the problem. Religions are always involved in some kind of sales pitch. They say, if you would do what I tell you or what we preach, it will be good for you. It will make something better. And endlessly, endlessly, it doesn't. So you might say, what is the good of studying this at all? If it doesn't improve your lives, if it doesn't make you better, more sociable, why study it? Well, the first thing that occurs to me is that it's very interesting. I've always, since childhood, been fascinated by the mystery of being. It just has always struck me as absolutely marvelous that there is this amazing universe. And just out of sheer wonder, I'm interested in all the various answers that people have given as to why this is here. And I must say that my approach to religion is not so much that of the moralist as of the scientist. In this sense, a physicist may have a very experimental and concrete approach to nature, but a good physicist is not necessarily a good man in the sense of being improved morally. He knows certain things. His knowledge is power. And the power that the physicist has may be used for good or for evil. But he has the power. He has the knowledge. And I've always thought that in many ways Zen is like that. Zen has been used for healing people's sicknesses and also for chopping off their heads by the samurai. And so I'm interested in it from the point of view of what it reveals about the way universe is, the way nature is, what this world is doing. So it is part and parcel of a big inquiry. And the big inquiry is this. If you read the literature of the great religions, time and time again you come up against descriptions of what is called spiritual experience. And you find that in all the various traditions there is a modality of spiritual experience which seems to be the same thing, whether it occurs in the Christian West, the Islamic Middle East, the Hindu world of Asia, or the Buddhist world. It is quite definitely the same experience. The sense of the transcendence of individuality and of being one with the total energy of the universe. This experience has always fascinated me. I've been interested in the psychological dynamics of it. Why it happens, what happens, how it comes to be described in different symbolisms with different languages. And to see if I could find out what are the means of bringing it about, frankly. I've often felt that the traditional ways of cultivating it are analogous to, say, medieval medicine, where a concoction is prepared that consists of roasted toads, rope from the gallows, henbane, mandrake, a boiled red dog, and all such things, you see, and a great brew is made. Now I assume that some sort of old wives' tradition had it so that this thing really did do you some good. But a modern chemist looks at that and says, this may have done some good, but what was the essential ingredient? And so I ask in the same way, when people do yoga, when they practice Zen, when they do the bhakti thing of religious devotion to a god of some kind, all the various things people do, even to the extent of taking psychedelic chemicals, what does all this have in common? What is the essential ingredient that takes place here? And let's cut out the nonsense, which is purely something that goes with the particular cultural background of a certain way of approach to this state of consciousness. I don't say nonsense. I shouldn't have used that word, because I could call it embellishments, decorations, not nonsense. But if we look behind that to what is essential, is there something that can be said about that? Now, it always strikes one at first, it struck me as a student of these things, that Zen got very close to essentials. This was a first impression. Because the way Suzuki presented it, it was the direct way. It was the sudden way of seeing right through into one's nature now, at this moment. And although there is a good deal of talk about that in Zen, in some ways it's more talk than practice. Although once at a dinner table, I remember Hasegawa saying, when somebody asks him, how long does it take to attain an understanding of Zen? He said, it may take you 3 minutes, it may take you 30 years. And he said, I mean that. And it's that 3 minutes, you see, that tantalizes people. We of the West want instant results. And one of the difficulties of instant results is that they're sometimes in poor quality. For example, most instant coffee is a punishment for people who are in too much of a hurry to get real coffee. And certainly, these dialer meal automat drive-in places where you put in your money and you have 12 choices and you dial a meal and it delivers it to you in exactly 60 seconds. You might just as well eat with the pigs. It looks prettier, but there's nothing much in it. So there is something to be said against hurry. But there are two sides to this. And it strikes me in this way. It isn't a matter of time at all. The people who think it ought to take a long time are one school of thought. The people who want it as quickly as possible, who are in fact in a hurry, is another school of thought, and they're both wrong. Because it is not a question of how much time you put into it, as if this added up some sort of quantitative scale and you got rewarded according to the amount of effort you put into it. Nor is there a way of avoiding the effort just to be lazy and say, I want it now. The point is rather something like this. If you try to get it either by an instant method or by a long-term method, you can't get it either way. The only thing that effort or absence of effort can teach you is that it doesn't work. The middle way is, Buddhism is always called the middle way. It's not just a sort of compromise situation. Middle here means above and beyond extremes. To him that hath shall be given. In other words, you can only get it when you discover that you don't need it. You can only get it when you don't want it. And so you say, how do I learn not to want it, not to go after this, either by the long-term method or by the instant method? And obviously, if you ask that, you still are seeking it, and thereby not getting it. If, as the Zen master says, you have a stick, I will give you one. If you have not, I'll take it away from you. Which is the same as to him that hath shall be given. And from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. So then, we are in a situation here where it seems that all our accustomed thinking, all our normal ways of thinking about solving problems doesn't work. All thinking based on acquisition is here obsolete. We have, as it were, to get into a new dimension of approaching this altogether. And that is why a young Zen student I know, he's now finished his Zen training, he's Japanese, said a little while ago, if I were asked what is really essential in Zen, it would be what is called Sanzen. That is the dialogue between the master and the student. The person-to-person contact. He said, rather than zazen, sitting meditation, or anything like that, it is the sanzen that is the crux of it. I don't think this was just a way of saying that the one thing that is essential is the apostolic succession. I think it's rather saying this, that it is in the peculiar circumstances of that dialogue that we can get into the dimension I'm talking about. Because you see, what in effect this dialogue is that the master always throws back to the student the question he's asked. He doesn't answer any questions. Not really. He merely throws the question back at you so that you yourself understand why you're asking it and why you are creating the problem which the question expresses. It's up to you. Who, me? Yeah, you. Well, you say, I can't. I don't know how to do it. Well, what do you mean by you? Who are you? Show me. You see, it's in this kind of back and forth that you begin to understand, through the relationship with the other person, that you're mixed up. You're asking the wrong questions. You're trying to solve the wrong problem altogether. It's a curious thing about gurus. You notice how people feel that gurus have marvelous eyes and that they look right through you. And people think, oh dear me, he sees to the bottom of my soul. He reads my history, my secret thoughts, my awful misdeeds and everything. He knows me right through. Such matters are of very little interest to a guru. When he looks at you with a funny look, he's seeing who you really are. Looking through your eyes to the divine center, let's put it that way. And here he sees Buddha, Brahman, whatever you want to call it, pretending like he's not at home. And no wonder he has a funny look on his face. But somehow the incongruity between the divine being that looks out through you in the eyes and the expression of puzzlement on the face. And what he's going to do is, by a dialogue, kid you out of this irresponsibility, this playing that you are someone else than you who you really are. And this, in you see, is of the essence. Don't mistake me. I'm not saying in order to get there you have to have a guru and go and find one somewhere. That too, you see, would go back into the ordinary dimension. Because you see, all the guru is doing, as I was explaining to some of you last night, you give him authority and you say, be my teacher. And in Zen they make it very tough for you to get a guru at all. And other gurus do, the Hindus do likewise, because they have various ways of explaining that a guru has to take on the karma of his student. And that's a pretty dangerous thing to do. He becomes responsible for him. But in Zen, they have the feeling they're going to make it very difficult. So that if you're going to make a fool of yourself by projecting authority on a guru, you're going to make a big fool of yourself. In no small measures about this. So the point then is this, that insofar as you accord spiritual authority to someone, you must recognize that you did that on your own authority. It was you who set this guy up as your master.
All right, you say, well, there are a lot of other people who've done it too, and they form a kind of community, and that gives authority to this figure, and that's why you pick it. You say, I want the best Zen master, see? Well, who's the best Zen master? How do you know? You go around asking people. You ask the Zen clique, you see? Who do you think's the really good master? Well, of course, they or people tend to recommend their own teacher. And when a guy has had enough people apply to him, then he's got a great collective authority. And you accept that and say, I'll go to that. But do you see, you have used this group as a pretext upon which to project your own authority, not realizing that you've done it. Now you set this thing up. And the task of the teacher is to show you just what you did. It all came from you. And that's what it means when the Buddhists say, all this world is in your own mind. When in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, the instructions are given as to what happens when the clear light of the void comes, when the vision of the blissful bodhisattvas, the vision of the wrathful bodhisattvas, and all that kind of thing. And the preceptor says, realize, O nobly born, that all this is but the outpouring of your own mind. It's you. But we can't take that very well because we've been taught most assiduously that you yourself are but a little thing in this world. You must be humble. You didn't create this world. Somebody else made it. And watch your P's and Q's. Don't have the spiritual pride of thinking for one minute that you are the cause of it. All right, you say, but how could I have made it? I don't know how it was made. But a Zen poem says, if you want to ask where the flowers come from, even the god of spring doesn't know. Because, as I said in the beginning, there is no way of defining the creative energy of the universe. If you addressed God, supposing God could come and talk to you, and you said to him, God, pretty complicated universe, amazing, how did you do it? See, I just did it, I don't know. Of course not. If he had to think out every detail of it, it never would have happened. Just in the same way, you breathe, you live, but you don't know how you do it, but you're doing it. Only we've been taught by our social convention to restrict the concept of myself to what I do voluntarily and consciously, which is very narrow. Certainly, if you say, oh, I, by my ego and my intelligence, I created all this, you would be conceited, and you know you would be a liar. But you is much deeper than that. You includes far more than your conscious mind. And it's that total you that not only is responsible for the infinitely complex structure of your physical organism, but also for the environment in which you find yourself. You runs that deep. So it's you in that sense, the total you, which is the root and ground of everything. But you see, we arrange a whole principle of human sociability, of ability to get on together, by putting everyone down. You're not the only pebble on the beach, as my mother used to say. Well, why not try the other technique of putting everyone up? It might be that they'd get along better that way than they would by putting everybody down. Because whatever you do, you have to do it unilaterally. I mean, you have to do it uniformly for everyone. You can't say, well, Johnny's the Lord God and Peter isn't. But as a result of this, you see, we all feel
strangers in the world, disconnected from it all, that it happens, it's something that happens to us, that we endure passively, that we receive passively, and we never get the point that actually you're doing the whole thing, and it's up to you. You make your troubles. You get yourself into the trap. And you confuse yourself, forget that you did it, and then ask how to get out of it. Looking around, says a verse from the Mumon Khan, asking where Buddha is like hiding loot in your pocket and declaring yourself innocent. So, you see, to admit, to come to the recognition that it was you, requires a certain kind of nerve. I don't mean nerve in the sense of when we say, well, he's got a lot of nerve, because somebody is just brash and cheeky. But nerve in the sort of sense that you use nerve when for the first time you take a plane off the ground, or when you pull a cloth off the table and leave all the dishes on the table. That sort of nerve. There's nothing to do with pride in the ordinary sense. It is ready to leap in somehow, you see. If people don't have that kind of sense, we have what I would call an ambivalent sense of responsibility. If we say, well, now look, you are only you, and you're just you, and but you have certain responsibilities, and they are thus and so. Well, that means then there are a lot of things I'm not responsible for. And so we play games as to where we're going to draw the line. And so we say to someone who's in psychological difficulty, who has been irresponsible in some way, well, why was he like that? And instead of referring it to him, we refer it back because of environment, because of family conditioning, because of his mother. And there's no end to that. You take that all straight back to Adam and Eve. And therefore responsibility is evaded. Because it was in the first place limited. We think, you see, that the world is explained by its past. That what happened in the past determines what is going to happen next. We don't really see that it's exactly the other way round. What is always the source of the world is the present. The past doesn't explain a thing. The past trails behind the present like the wake of a ship and eventually disappears. And now you would say, obviously, when you see a ship crossing the ocean and the wake trailing behind it, that the ship is the cause of the wake. But if you get into the state of mind that believes in causality as we do, you're trying to make the wake the cause of the ship. That is surely making the tail wag the dog. So the point is, you will never find the mystery of the creation of the world in the past. It never was created in the past. Because really and truly, there is nothing else, there never was anything else except the present. There never will be. Life is always present, and the past is a kind of echo, a kind of tracings within the present of what the present did before. We can say, we can guess what the present will do next because of what it has done in the past. True, because through what it does habitually, you may guess that it will go on doing it like that. But it isn't that the past controls the present. It's just that from the record of the past, you study the nature of the present and what sort of things it's likely to do. And sometimes it surprises you when something new happens, as every so often it does. So it is always from the immediate here and now that things begin. And so you might say one of the complete essentials of Zen training is here and now, boys. Be here. And you see, in order to be here, you mustn't be looking for a result. People keep saying to me, well, why do you do that? Why did you come here? What do you want to get out of this? Well, this implies, you see, that my motivation is different from my action. It's talking about life in terms of Newtonian billiards. Newton's mechanics of the world, in his explanation of behavior, was always by analogy with billiards. Balls, the fundamental atoms, are banging each other about. And so a ball will be still until something bangs it. Then that will be its motivation, and that will set it going. So when we say human beings behave in such and such a way because of unconscious mental mechanisms, that is Newtonian psychology. It's out of date. We need today a psychology up to quantum theory, at least, where you don't have this conception of mechanical causality. And it's difficult to understand unless you turn things round by the analogy of the ship and the wake, and you understand fully that it is from the present that everything happens. And that the only place for you to be, the only place for you to live, is here. Now immediately people say, now wait a minute, it's all very well, but I want to be sure that under such and such eventualities and such circumstances, I'll be able to deal with it. It's all very well to live in the present where I'm sitting comfortably in a warm room and I'm meditating. But what am I going to do if all hell breaks loose, if there's an earthquake, if I get sick, or my best friends get sick, or some catastrophe happens? How will I deal with that? Mustn't I prepare myself to deal with that? Mustn't I get into some sort of psychological training so that when disasters come, I won't be thrown? That, you would ordinarily think, is the way to proceed. But it doesn't work very well. It's much better to say, sufficient unto the day is the trouble thereof. I will trust myself to react appropriately when the catastrophe happens. Because failure of nerve is really failure to trust yourself. You have a great endowment of brain, of muscle, of sensitivity, intelligence. Trust it to react to circumstances as they arise. There's a whole thing in Zen about this, reacting to circumstances as they arise. Wait and see how you deal with it, because the you that will deal with it will not be simply the conscious intelligence, the conscious attention. It will be all of you. And that is beyond the control of the will. Because the will is only a fragment, having certain limited functions. But if you really know how to live centered now, and to know that now is the origin of everything, you stand a much better chance of being able to deal with the unforeseen than if you keep worrying about it and considering past lessons and future possibilities. I know that sounds revolutionary, and it sounds, in a way, impractical. But it is simply living in the present in this way means a certain kind of poise. If you make plans exactly how to deal with the future and things don't happen at all as you expected, you get thoroughly discombobulated. But if you don't make any but very flexible plans, you have to make some plans, make them flexible, be adaptable, and always be here. So you are exactly as in judo. In judo, you always keep balanced. You keep your center of gravity between your feet. And you don't cross your feet like that, because the moment you do so, you're off balance. So you're always in the center position. That means you're always here. And it doesn't matter which direction the attack comes from. If you're expecting it this way, and you're all sort of inclined this way to get ready for it, and it comes another way, alas, you're too late. So you stay in the center, and you're ready to flow out in any direction from which an attack may come. So this is centeredness. And the whole point, the whole real meaning of the practice of Zazen, sitting Zen, is to sit in the center, to be centered. That's what it really means. So, therefore, to do Zazen, in order that this is some kind of technique for attaining enlightenment, is a mistaken approach. Fundamentally. I would, however, say this. You must read, if you haven't read it, Kaplow's book, The Three Pillars of Zen, and especially the autobiographical parts of it, where various students give their experiences in the long session, that means study of mind. Don't confuse it with session, S-E-S-S-I-O-N. Session, S-E-S-S-H-I-N. Session is the study of the mind-heart. And it means the long periods of meditation. And some masters work it so that they work you to a very high degree of expectation. They make you desire to get this thing by all means by the end of the session. And they make you more and more frustrated, more as the session goes on and your knees hurt more and everything gets perfectly desperate. They go to fan the flame of desire and your anxiety to get this thing. But that's working in reverse, you see. What they're doing is boiling you away. burning you out. Until you reach, you see, through a reductio ad absurdum, you reach the point where you see, in the intensity of frustration, that it was all here anyhow. There was nothing to realize, because the present is it. Well, that's one way of doing it, you see. The other way is to try and get people to sit just to sit. After all, why not sit? To sit sometime. And you may as well, when you sit, really sit. Be quite here. You see, the wandering of the mind away from the matter in hand, away from the present, is to think through the implications of the present. In other words, when you look down and you're meditating, you're perfectly okay to be aware of anything that's around, the floor, the smell of the atmosphere, the little noises going on, be there. But when you hear a dog bark, and that starts off a train of thought about dogs in general and your dog and somebody else's dog and whatnot, then you see you've wandered away from being here. Until, of course, you finally come to the point when you realize there is no way of wandering away from being here. There's nowhere else to be, even if you think about somewhere else. Past or future. This is all happening now. And then you can understand how to be a scholar and a historian, if you will, and still live in the present. That's Suzuki's secret. How to be
scholarly and intellectual, and yet at the same time, in the midst of being intellectual, not to depart at all from the spirit of Zen, which is beyond the intellect. You can intellectualize in a Zen way, just as you can sweep floors in a Zen way. But the key of the matter is, of course, centering. To be really here. Because that's the point of origin of the world. And it is at the same time the destination of the world. Now that is the real meaning of dhyana in Sanskrit, the kind of concentration meditation which constitutes Zen. Zen is the Japanese way of pronouncing dhyana. And it's that state of centeredness, here and now. So then, Blythe, in talking with me about, I questioned him at great length about what he thought of Zen practice, and he told me this story. He said, you know, I asked a Zen master, what would you do if you knew you had only half an hour more to live? Would you take a walk in the garden? Would you listen to your favorite music? Would you sleep with a girlfriend? Would you go and see some friends? What would you do? And he said, I would practice Zazen. And Blythe said, oh, come on. He said, you know, it's a superstition. Many of these monks practice Zazen because they think that somehow it generates merit. The more time you sit like that, the more somehow you do something for the world, you just like you would chant a sutra. He said, the trouble with these people is they've forgotten other ways of practicing Zen. Riding a bicycle Zen, for example. Shopping Zen. Driving a car Zen. Said, these are, if you don't do it in these ways, he said, you don't do it at all. But it's become a fixation, that it's the sitting meditation exercise that is the be-all and the end-all of Zen practice. And he was very strong about this. If you read his last volume of Zen and Zen Classics, which I think was an essay called No Japanese Zen, Thank You, it is a very strong criticism of this one-sided ecclesiastical Zen with its tremendous focus on the Zazen discipline. Now, I want to qualify this in a minute, but I think this point has to be made first. It has got one-sided in that respect. I don't think there's any question about it. And people enter into Zazen games. I suffered more than you did. I sat longer than you did. Why, you've been only to one session? It's like people with LSD. You mean you've only taken 250 micrograms? Well, I once took 1,000. You don't really blow your mind, man, until you've been beyond 500. It's the same sort of one-upmanship. It's amazing how these things repeat themselves. And all the quarrel over who has the true sacrament. Phew. Now, on the other hand, there's a great deal to be said for Zazen practice. And for sutra chanting. But if
the whole question of it is to get into the spirit of when it's good. You should listen very carefully to the voice of a person chanting sutras and find out whether he swings or not. Is he doing this as a dreary duty that is good for him? Or is he with it? And so often you hear the dreary duty. You can hear it in the voices of Catholic priests who are tired to death. Hail Mary, full of grace, Lord is with thee, blessed art thou among women, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Hail Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now at the hour of death. You know, quick as possible, just get the hell out of here. Say so many of these things and it'll work. And in the meantime, they're thinking about baseball. But there is a way when you get, say, with a group of people in a chant and you are completely with it. And this is you're having a ball. And you can go on for hours because it's just like dancing. Well, so in the same way with practicing Zazen. You can sit and play and enjoy yourself being quiet. And it's not a duty at all. It's a great pleasure. Get up early in the morning when the sunlight is just beginning to show. Doesn't matter where you are, Japan or anywhere. And just sit. And don't have any thoughts. I mean, don't compulsively get rid of thoughts, but it's just not important. The thing is, what is? What is here now? Yeah, I mean, after all, here you are. You may as well see it. And you get this curious feeling. It's very hard to describe. Maybe it isn't. I just said that the origin of the world is now. The odd sensation that now comprises everything. The most distant past, the most remote future. The vastnesses of space, all galaxies, etc., etc. All states of experience, all joy, all sorrow, all heights, all depths, everything is now. And there isn't anywhere else to be. Never was, never will be. That's why you never were born. Therefore you can't die. You never came, so you won't go. You were always here. It's very curious. Because, no, not really curious, but it's just so different from what we ordinarily think. And it's that entering into the now, which is what we call the eternal now, finding infinity in the split second, or as they say in yoga, that liberation lies in the interval between two thoughts, between the past thought and the future thought. Because, you see, there is no present thought. As one of the Zen texts says, one thought follows another without interruption. But if you allow these thoughts to link up into a chain, you put yourself in bondage. Actually, this present moment never comes to be, and it never ceases to be. In this, it's like nirvana. So Dogen explains that in the course of the seasons, the spring does not become the summer. And when wood burns, the wood does not become the ashes. There is the state of wood, and then there is the state of ashes. There is the state of spring, and later the state of summer. But the spring does not become the summer. The wood does not become the ashes. The living body does not become the corpse. That is linking the thoughts together. Oh, I shall become a corpse. You won't. you won't be there when you're a corpse. So, I would say then that if we are going to introduce Westerners to the fundamentals of Zen, we need to revise a bit the procedures and rationale of meditation. So that it doesn't become a competitive one-upmanship marathon as to who can take this, who can endure, because then that puts it under the domain of time. The important thing to emphasize is presence, being completely here, and not feeling guilty if you enjoy it. And you can do that most easily in any kind of activity that does not require much discursive thought. So, in other words, if you want to be shucking peas or digging a plot of ground or putting up a fence or anything which you can do without a great deal of discursive thought, it's perfectly good for meditation. In Buddhism, there are what they call the four dignities of man. And they are walking, standing, sitting, and lying. And so Zazen is simply sitting Zen. There is also lying Zen, which is sleeping Zen. Of when you sleep, sleep. There is standing Zen, and there is walking Zen. And there is a very good method of meditation, is the walking method. That's where you have a cloister that you can simply stroll around. But be here. Now, there is a difficulty that people come into with this. They get the feeling of, well, is it only this? I mean, is this all? Nothing seems to be happening much, but just what's going on? I feel a little frustrated. I feel particularly enlightened. It's just nothing special at all. I mean, I wonder, do I have to do this longer in order for something to happen? Or what? No, there's nothing special supposed to happen. It's just that this here is it. But you see, you have difficulty in accepting it. Because you still feel, the lack of nerve to see that you are all of it. You are not an observer who is witnessing the present moment as something happening to you. If you feel it that way, then you naturally ask, well, what next? The important thing is that this present which you are experiencing is all of you. It's not you here looking at the floor there. The floor is just as much you as the organism looking at it. You are doing the floor just like you're doing your feet. It's all one world. And you're responsible for it. So have a good time.